I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. What's the matter with kids today? Well, our culture seems increasingly self-centered and self-absorbed, and that's the same with our youth culture, where children often do not have the sort of connections they need from the adults around them. Encouragement and compassion are lacking, and young people seem disconnected and disengaged despite the proliferation of technology around us. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Unger, an internationally recognized expert on resilience in at-risk youth, who leads the International Resilience Project. He is a clinician and research professor at the School of Social Work at Dalhousie. He lives in Halifax and joins me in Vancouver this day. He is the author of a fascinating and timely book, We Generation, Raising Socially Responsible Kids. His previous books include Too Safe for Their Own Good. We Generation is published by McClelland and Stewart and retails for $19.99. The website for more is michaelunger.com. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Michael Unger. Good morning, Dr. Unger.
Oh, good morning.
Are we still a me generation, or is it children today? When you talk about the generation that we're in, that the kids are in, I guess, what is it, 5 to 20?
Yeah, if you look at the 5 to 20-year-olds, I think if we are going to refer to a me generation, we probably have to, with some hesitancy, perhaps assign it to the people who are parenting this upcoming generation, not so much the kids themselves. I mean, I know that kind of will go against what most people believe, but I'm kind of optimistic when I work with young people, either through my research or my clinical practice. What I keep seeing is a group of kids who, in part because of the technology they have and because they live in a world that's a little more global, they seem to be able to think we. And certainly if we as adults give them the opportunity and try to influence them, teach them to have some respect for other people. Just very simple example, right? If you look at the music they listen to, I mean, you got a generation growing up on a very democratic kind of sense of what music they can select, right? They have the choice now. They can drift around the world and download just about anything that they want. Hopefully they do it legally. But, you know, so eclectic what they can choose, be it from Cuba or South American jazz, something from Asia, perhaps some Bollywood soundtrack, and then they jump over to South African, some sort of reggae-infused, heavy beat kind of music or something like that. I mean, we have such a sense of choice now for our children. And you combine that with, if you can get traveling with them, or if you can kind of just bring in exchange students into your own home, or do fundraising with your children in terms of thinking about global issues. I mean, I'm really, in a sense, seeing in this generation a strong desire to think globally, but also to make a contribution locally, to really sort of give back to their communities and to those people around them.
And children today, they're more tolerant, do you think, in terms of race, culture, gender even?
My experience with kids, even kids who are potentially delinquent or in very sort of troubled situations, is that, yes, I do see a lot of evidence that the kids today have been, in a sense, learning from us adults. I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I would say that a lot of the efforts that myself and my contemporaries have been sort of groundbreakers in terms of, well, trying to think we as well, trying to break down some of those barriers. I think the kids are getting it. I just see them much more tolerant than when I was growing up, much less likely to sort of espouse things that are really, negative or racial slurs, those kinds of things against others. And, you know, it's almost kind of funny because sometimes you'll hear that coming out of their mouth. And I remember just recently hearing a 7-year-old say something quite derogatory that was kind of racist and was on the streets and stuff. I thought to myself, there's no way that kid got that out of their own mouth from their own brain thinking that up. I mean, that's got to be, mimicking some adult who said that to them. So what that says to me is that, while that's a negative, the potential in that is exactly the opposite, isn't it? Because we as adults, we as parents, can influence kids so dramatically, and that is still very much a potential for us to help kids realize and think we thinking thoughts, to have that sort of to break maybe sort of repair some of the me thinking ways of my generation.
I'm 26, and so I guess I'm
on the cusp of it.
Yeah, I'm past the age where I'm have been raised, and I'm not don't have the desire at this point to have children anytime soon. So, do you think there's been a difference between the way that I was raised and say that the kids of today have been raised, or?
Well, I think you would have been just on the cusp of a huge change in terms of, I mean, if you even, you know, look at where did you get your music 10, 15 years ago? How did you learn about social issues around the globe? Did you watch Discovery Channel? Did you have access to sort of this hundreds of channel universe? Did you have a sense of the world as very connected? Could you just, you know, sign on to YouTube and watch President Obama's speech as many people have done? There is a sense here of, you know, our online connections. Well, some people have said, "Oh, well, people don't, you know, our kids only they've got too much screen time and all this kind of stuff." I'm actually going to sort of look forward and say that, and this might reflect your life. I'm about 20 years older than you, but I'm going to suggest that all this potential of the web and everything else is giving us the opportunity to really connect, and that kids don't just want to be on the screens; they actually want the sort of the flesh and blood connections as well. They want to know that they can make a difference. And that hasn't changed. They want opportunities to make a contribution. And it begins very young as well, doesn't it? I mean, the 5-year-old who wants to help, you know, bake the cookies in the kitchen sort of thing, as is a very sort of common, stereotypical kind of thing. You know, they're climbing up, they're making noise about being in your face and being part of the family routine. You know, those kids, if you know, sort of given a little bit of effort and brought into those activities and made to shine a little bit and be proud of their contribution, then grow up into kids that are few years older, and they're beginning to sort of say, well, you know, no, we should help each other. And they get a real pride, a real buzz off of knowing that they're shining in the eyes of others, and maybe, you know, they've helped bring in the groceries, or they've helped shop, or they've helped make some decisions in the family, or walk the family dog, or those kinds of things. All of a sudden, those become very crucial roles that they perform for us. You keep that stuff up for another 10 years, and what you're probably going to get, and I actually in the book give an example of some questions you can ask yourself to just look at how well your child's developing into sort of a citizen, someone who's going to make a contribution. Once you sort of get to that point, you have a kid who's in their teenage years is more likely to value connections with adults and also to be willing to make a contribution back. And I've got to tell you, this is going to sound a bit strange, but I've even seen this in kids who are quite delinquent. I even worked, at one point I was working in a jail setting in a secure custody facility. And believe it or not, these are amongst kids who are the total deep end kids, the ones that, you know, they make the front pages of the newspaper for all the wrong reasons. And even then, I remember vividly that the highest responsibility that you could have in that jail was being allowed to ride the ride-on lawnmower and mow the grass in the facility. Now, that just sounds absurd. Why would a kid want to mow the lawn? But the whole point of it was is that even the kids who are, you know, really out of sorts with society, they want to know that they can make a contribution. They want that sort of that little buzz that we get when other people are watching us do something for the benefit of others. And it's healing. It's also foundational to kids growing up and thinking we, as much as possible. Those kinds of things are just great experiences for kids.
So what can parents do before they lose their children and they morph into that stereotype of teenagers who, you know, are in front of the computer all the time and slam doors?
Yeah. Well, I think what we can remember is that our kids want us in their lives. You can think of it a whole bunch of different ways. One, you can make it's not just quality of time, it's also quantity. It's important that you're there when the kids are around. You know, if you have the flexibility in your time schedule, or you can sort of make it possible just to sort of be there. Be there when the kids are sort of drifting through the kitchen looking for food. Be there in the car driving them to events if that's part of your routine as well. And never sort of underestimate that if you just put yourself in front of them or beside them, that they feel reassured that you're there, that you're part of their lives. You don't have to go to every single game, every single event of their lives, but sometimes just the extending yourself, just spending that time. But the other thing we can also do very concretely is shape our environment around our kids. Expect of them the things. Expect them to have dinner with you 3 nights a week. Expect of them to cook a dinner once a week or once every couple of weeks if they're sort of in a you know, maybe over the age of 12, that kind of thing. Parents are already running, oh my God, I don't know why I'd want to eat what they cook, but you know, get them involved. Get them to shine in the light of, you know, being a part of the family. And shape the environment around them. You know, if you have three televisions, narrow it down to one or maybe maximum two, so that kids learn how to sort of, you know, negotiate, share space. Maybe you'll put you both on the same couch occasionally as well. Plus, you'll get a chance to see what they're watching. And who knows, they might actually get a chance to watch what you're watching. And perhaps there'll be an exchange, or they'll get exposed to something beyond just the Family Guy and the Family Channel, or whatever they've been watching that, you know, maybe you don't want them watching. Well, you know, once you have three televisions and three remotes, that's where the problem begins. And what I'm realizing is the more we sort of realize as parents, we have a lot of levers if we want our kids to think we can structure their environment so they have more time with us to influence them, and are perhaps less selfish in their behaviors.
And then this benefits parents in the long run, because eventually the children will take care of them.
There is a subtle irony in all this, isn't there? That ultimately, at the end of the day, they're going to be looking after us, absolutely. And I can't help but think they're also going to be the government. They're going to be the policymakers. They're the ones who are going to designate whether or not funding. Like, there's a subtle irony in all this, eh? When we vote against the local skateboard parks, or we vote down initiatives to put in some activity centers for youth, or you know, something that was meaningful to our kids, that we've got to remember that, you know, 30 years from now, they're the ones who are going to have to vote on whether or not to expand the sort of social safety net for us. It does go around, and I can't help but think that, in a sense, I am actually very optimistic about this, because I think my generation has made a lot of effort to make our communities much more, you know, child-friendly. We have better parks. We do have a lot of recreational facilities. And I think the kids kind of get the message of that's what citizenship, especially here in Canada, is all about. It's a you know, we do have a sense of sort of social justice. It doesn't always work. We have a lot of problems with it. But they hear about it in school. We built it into our curriculums, even to the extent that in my school system, certainly where I come from in Nova Scotia, our kids even have to do in high school 50 hours of volunteer time as part of their curriculum to graduate, 50 hours per year. So, you know, those are initiatives that weren't there when I was growing up, and I just think it's just wonderful to see us kind of shaping the world and making those expectations on our children.
You alluded earlier to the need of touch. Well, why do you think we've discounted touch in recent years?
Well, what I've really understood is that compassion, if we really want to show compassion for our children, we need to model it. And I do actually devote in Regeneration a whole chapter just to touch, because it's just so fundamental. I unfortunately worked with children who have been raised in environments where they're not touched, or where we've created zero touch policy, you know, no touch policies in our schools and communities. And the children are missing something, because, I mean, it comes down, let's reason this out. If we raise children where there's absolutely no touch, however in the world will they understand the difference between a good touch and a bad touch? It's like, if we don't let them, under the watchful gaze of our educators or parents, if we never let them have a snowball fight, how will they ever realize the difference between a sort of a big icy snowball and a nice fluffy one that sort of, you know, explodes beautifully on impact? And like, how does a kid learn that if they don't experiment, if they don't sort of understand the difference between, you know, how their actions affect others? So that's what I'm really big on, is that I think we do need to touch children. I think we're getting much better at avoiding the sexual abuse problems. We know now that you don't pat a child on their bottom on the sports field and all that kind of silly stuff. We know that we train our coaches and our clergy, and we train our educators, and even we've talked a lot about this, about how you sort of engage a child so they don't feel threatened. You do it safely, but gosh darn, I see this all over the world in my travels, that touch often is a you know, when done respectfully, is a way that children feel loved and engaged and a part of their communities. And when we don't give them that, they just, I think there's a coldness, a chill that enters, that they don't necessarily feel like they belong or that they're valued as much as need be.
And the importance of other adults in children, in the lives of children, sort of like grandparents and the sort. You talk in the book about Alan Arkin in Little Miss Sunshine, and it breaks your heart just to think about it, that scene with his granddaughter, and that, I guess they were rehearsing for the pageant or whatever.
Yeah.
Is that relationship typical, do you think, of children today, that they have those connections with their grandparents or other adults?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think it is still relatively common, especially when people, you know, live close enough. Now, I'm not sure every community in Canada has that privilege. A lot of us have migrated away from our families of origin. But yet, I'm also realizing that there are lots of families that have found other surrogate grandparents, people who sort of fill that role. Or an extended family member, or sometimes it's just multiple families just getting together on a street, on a block, where the child feels like they're under the gaze of a whole bunch of people, or that there's somebody with complementary skills. When my own children just recently, my son was getting into some activity. He wanted to build something in the basement, and it was outside. It was something to do with electricity and batteries, and I didn't know anything about this. But an older gentleman who lives sort of around the corner from us builds cars for himself, and you know, retrofits cars and all kinds of stuff. And I had my son just go over and talk to him, and sure enough, a few hours later, he's back home, and he's got some sort of old battery, and he's got some cables, and he's got some sort of thing he's doing, and I didn't understand it. But it does take that sort of sense of community, and I think all of us can remember those kinds of stories. We've got to stop being fearful of our neighbors. We've got to start sort of making our communities. If you're living in a suburban, you know, community with those, you know, larger, you know, 2,500, 3,000 square foot homes on, you know, streets with the garages pushed forward and nobody ever on the street walking and talking, and it's difficult to connect. I mean, there are solutions to that. There's, you know, block parties, and there's, you know, everyone pulls their barbecue out front once a year or twice a year, that kind of thing. Those kinds of efforts are just absolutely necessary if we want our kids to think we, because it can't be, no parent could possibly meet all the needs of a kid. And by letting your kid sort of branch out, find these other supports, you're going to also teach them the skill set that they need to become good citizens, to realize they're within a community, and that not only do they value the contribution of others, they'll grow up and make that contribution back. It will pay forward, if you will.
You write in the book that that sex has become a substitute for emotional intimacy. Have you found that there's a rise in sexual activity amongst youth?
What actually it seems to be is that kids are either shutting down and withdrawing, or you do have a group of kids. I work with sometimes a pretty specialized group of kids who are quite emotionally withdrawn from their parents, or who don't necessarily get a lot of their needs met. And I have seen a pattern, or my fear is that when you're not modeling appropriate touch, and you're not giving your child time, real, you know, sort of connection, that you do run the risk of the child turning to early sexual activity as a way of basically replacing you. Because intimacy, often, the stereotype of the younger girl and the older guy, a lot of the kids that I meet who get into trouble through those kinds of relationships are often saying that they really weren't looking for the sex. What they were looking for was the connection and the sense of themselves as older, a place where they can make a contribution to the welfare of someone else. Those things, those kinds of activities and risky behaviors are actually quite preventable if we give our children more of a sense of those connections be outside of those sexualized relationships. There is a connection. Am I seeing more of it? Not necessarily. In fact, statistically, we know that children are no more sexually active today than they were, well, two generations ago. But what I would say is that it's totally preventable. What's different today is we really do know how to prevent children from doing this. And the children themselves are saying that, you know, I'd be quite happy to live my life in a much safer way if I was given the opportunity.
And you write in the book that the suburbs aren't a good place to raise kids. Is that correct?
I hint that the way we're organizing our suburbs have some challenges. That it's more challenging in a suburb to raise a child to think we than it is necessarily in sort of in a more urban environment, or perhaps a rural environment. In the rural environment, of course, people tend to be more connected to their neighbors out of necessity. There's a lot more, you know, sense of who's plowing whose driveway and all those kinds of things, right? There's a bit of a survival mentality. And if you look back at when you design streets with sort of where there are sight lines, where the community is watching your child on the street, where the sight lines are down, you know, from the apartment, you know, sort of 2 and 3 story high, sort of more denser housing, we know from lots of studies on urban design that people tend to be a little bit safer. In a sense, they tend to fall under the social gaze of their neighbors, and people are much more likely to intervene in each other's lives. But so it's not that the suburbs are necessarily bad; it's that we haven't necessarily realized that you can't just everybody have their own little plot, their own little family room, their own backyards, their own pool, their own trampoline, their own everything, and expect our kids to grow up feeling a social consciousness. You got to break down those barriers. You got to get people on the street. You got to get your kid being able to sort of make a contribution to the welfare of somebody else. If you don't, I'm not sure where they're just going to magically learn it. And that's really what I've been trying to say in the book, in We Generation, was to try and give parents lots of examples of how families have struggled, even inside the suburbs. And I give, for instance, a simple example of some friends of mine who, you know, they've been on a street. It's been a fairly stable group of people. Year after year, you know, they've gotten to know their neighbors, they've broken down those barriers, and so much so that they have a couple of kids, and their cat was celebrating his 10th birthday. Now, that might sound kind of funny, but it turned into this block party in which they basically celebrated the cat's birthday. And all of a sudden, just on a spontaneous Saturday afternoon whim, there was cat treats and a cake, and soon every child around the neighborhood was over there, and then there were some games. And, I mean, the kitty ended up hiding underneath the sofa, it was so afraid. But the whole idea was that people knew each other by name, and that someone, in this case, this woman, Laura Lee, had taken the initiative to reach out to her neighbors and to make sure that people were known to each other. That's hard to do in a city or in a suburb or in the rural areas as well. But that is the kind of stuff that we got to remember. Our children are watching us do that. So it's not just good for us. It's also going to be great for the kids in terms of what they learn.
Finally, Dr. Unger, how old are your kids, by the way?
I have a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old.
Well, when people meet you, do they presume that you've raised them really well and that you're the best parent, probably because of your work?
Oh, unfortunately. And the fact is, I mean, it's a running joke, of course, right? Is that you know, I struggle. Oh my gosh, it's hard conversations. And when my son wants to talk at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, and I keep thinking, oh my God, I wrote that in that book, I'm supposed to be here in quantity time, and I'm exhausted. I was up at 6 o'clock this morning, and I take a deep breath and I say to him, "Why don't we chat for 10 minutes? But I've really got to get to bed because I've got a really rough day tomorrow," or something like that. And I'm honest with him.
Yeah.
So I'm not, you know, I have the same challenges, but I do say that I have tried a lot of these ideas. And to tell you the truth, a lot of the wisdom in the book is actually from other families. It's not just my wisdom. I'm a traveling troubadour. I get to collect stories and pass them along, and I think that's why, if anything, those are the stories that work the best, when they're really from families who have struggled, not just mine, but other people.
This is a fascinating book, Dr. Unger. Thanks for joining us today, and continued good luck with it.
Oh, the very best. Thanks.
The book is called We Generation, Raising Socially Responsible Kids. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. $19.99 is the price. Dr. Michael Unger on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.